This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, March 23rd, 2006. I'm Aaron Glenn, sitting in for Aldo Bogado. Congressional candidates call for the impeachment of President Bush. Kurdish leaders in Iraq reel after protests by their subjects. And a look at the human right to water. But first, these news headlines.
From WBAI in New York, I'm Mitch Jezrich with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Basque separatist group, also known as ETA, has declared a permanent ceasefire with the Spanish government. For four decades, ETA has been involved in an armed struggle for the independence of the Basque region of northern Spain and southwest France. In a statement, the group said its objective now is to start a new democratic process. Spanish Socialist Prime Minister José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero said the government was cautious but hopeful about the announcement. Attorney General Alberto González announced an indictment against dozens of members of the Colombian rebel group, the FARC.
A federal indictment was unsealed today in Washington, D.C., charging 50 members of FARC's policymaking and operational leadership with importing more than $25 billion worth of cocaine into the United States and other countries.
In addition, the State Department announced rewards totaling more than $75 million for information, leading to the capture of dozens of FARC leaders. The leftist rebel group was formed in the 1960s and has been engaged in a long struggle to overthrow the U.S.-backed government in Bogota. The United States considers FARC a terrorist organization. NBC is reporting that a top official in Saddam Hussein's government was a paid spy for the CIA. It also reports that the spy gave the intelligence agency information that contradicted the Bush administration's assertions of Saddam Hussein's weapons programs. Jessica Silver Greenberg reports.
Iraq's foreign minister traded insider information on Saddam's weapons program to the CIA through covert transactions with the French intelligence agency. In September 2002, Iraq's foreign minister, Naji Sabri, was on the CIA's payroll trading information on Hussein's alleged weapons program for cash through the French intelligence agency. Before the U.S.-led invasion in 2003, Sabri was paid roughly $100,000 in return for spying on Saddam. Assessing Saddam's weapons program, Sabri said that while Saddam wanted to acquire a nuclear bomb, he needed much more time than the CIA had estimated. Sabri denied that Saddam had biological weapons, information clearly in conflict with 2002 national intelligence estimates. Since the U.S.-led invasion, no chemical or biological weapons have been found. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, this is Jessica Silver Greenberg.
Also in Iraq, fighters attacked the mayor's office in Baghdad and a police station south of the capital, killing four officers. General Motors announced it has struck a deal with the United Auto Workers Union to offer GM employees as much as $140,000 to leave their jobs. GM will also offer employees with 30 years of service at the GM spinoff of Delphi $35,000 to retire. The move comes in part so that GM can cut its labor costs and decrease its losses that are in the billions. But labor journalist David Bacon also says it's a way for the auto industry to decrease the worker pool here in the United States.
As part of the restructuring of the auto industry in general, a lot of those auto industry jobs have been relocated to other countries, for instance, so it's cheaper for General Motors to produce elsewhere. Delphi also is interested in transferring production. In order to be able to do that, they need to be able to, or they want to be able to, cut their U.S. workforce, not just by laying off people on a temporary basis, but by eliminating their jobs permanently.
Delphi says it will continue talks in an effort to achieve a comprehensive agreement with the UAW. A government watchdog group has filed a lawsuit to stop the Budget Deficit Reduction Act from taking effect. The act makes billions of dollars in cuts to social programs such as Medicare, Medicaid, and student loans. The group, Public Citizen, claims that the bill is unconstitutional because the House of Representatives and the Senate approved different versions of the bill. Adina Rosenbaum is the attorney on the case.
Under the Senate version of the bill that was passed, certain medical equipment could receive Medicare repayments for only 13 months. And in the version that was sent to the House, it allowed repayments for that certain medical equipment, durable medical equipment such as hospital beds and wheelchairs, to be made for up to 36 months. So the bill passed the House with a 36-month provision in it and then was sent back to the Senate, where in the process of putting it together to present it to the President, they put the 13-month provision back in. So the version that was sent to the President had the provision with regards to durable medical equipment that was in the version of the bill that passed the Senate, but that was not the same as the version that passed the House. And the president purported to sign that version into law.
If Public Citizen is successful, the entire Budget Deficit Reduction Act, including all the cuts to social programs, could be nullified. And those are some of the headlines. I'm Mitch Jezrich for Free Speech Radio News.
Today is World Water Day. Today is also the closing day of the 4th World Water Forum in Mexico City. Inside and outside the official forum, the human right to water access and how to best provide and administer water have been frequent topics of debate. Shannon Young and Vladimir Flores file this report from Mexico City.
Most governments, most nations believe that water is a public good.
Gordon Young, coordinator of the UN's World Water Assessment Program.
Just as clean, fresh air is a public good. Everybody needs it. Everybody deserves it.
Throughout the course of the 4th World Water Forum, there has been a push by a number of governmental and civil society groups to include water as a human right in the closing ministerial declaration. Young explains.
It means there should be a basic right to have sufficient water for personal and domestic use. In other words, enough safe water to drink and to cook with, and for personal hygiene, because that is so health-related.
Just how to provide that water has also been the subject of a contentious debate. The World Water Council, which organizes the World Water Fora, includes a number of private interests, such as representatives of private water service companies. In the past, the council has favored a push for increased private sector control over water utilities, saying that private companies are often more efficient at providing services and infrastructure for a lower price. Outside of the official event, people from around the world gathered to debate the future of water. During a public discussion at an alternative forum, this audience member from Peru called into question the repeated demand for the inclusion of water as a human right in the ministerial declaration without specific conditions.
These companies are telling us that they are providing potable water, and it's completely false. The only thing they do is chlorinate the water and eliminate some bacteria, but they are giving us dirty water, contaminated water. Is this the same water that you are proposing that we distribute to the world as a human right? This water filled with heavy metals? This water that ends up causing birth defects or cancer? I don't think this is a human right. We need to take this to another level. Modern companies that effectively deliver quality water to the population, where the president or the company boss opens the tap, serves himself a glass of water, and drinks it. Water in Latin America is only useful for washing plates, clothes, hands, cars, or for watering the garden, but not for drinking. Those who can buy bottled water are the only ones who drink clean water.
At this weekend's International Forum in Defense of Water, the rejection of water privatization seemed unanimous. The discussion instead focused on ways to effectively administer public sector water services. Oscar Oliveira helped organize mass mobilizations in 2000 that forced the Bechtel Corporation to abandon its takeover of the water utility in Cochabamba, Bolivia. Since then, citizen-based models of water administration have emerged in different parts of South America.
It's about building a new type of participatory space from the ground up, which also means the involvement of the population in public administration, not just leaving it up to the experts or to the workers to administer water, but also to the people who know what their needs are and are willing to give creative and effective solutions to their problems.
The public water utility in the southern Indian state of Tamil Nadu has also undergone a process of democratization of water management.
It'll be sad if the entire water crisis and the need for fresh perspectives on water gets boiled down to only the private versus the public debate. The issue is much larger than that.
Dr. V. Suresh is a management consultant for the Tamil Nadu State Water Utility.
The larger issue is the issue of how are we going to manage overall water in a context of climate change. Because we have to understand that managing water today is not just an imperative for today or tomorrow. It's an imperative and it's a duty that we owe to future generations as yet unborn. It's a responsibility which we cannot shrug away easily. It's also a responsibility that we cannot put for tomorrow. Because unless we do something today, we may perhaps not have tomorrow. That is the context we are living in. And we really don't have much time to sit back and ruminate on things and come out with fancy theoretical propositions. We have to really get down to basics in the here and the now, in the day to day. We have to assert that water is one commodity on which you can't play games.
In Mexico City, I'm Shannon Young with Vladimir Flores for Free Speech Radio News.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture plans to scale back testing for mad cow disease this year, at a time when the USDA is still finding new cases. Washington correspondent Matt Kay reports.
Top Democrat on the Senate Agriculture Committee, Tom Harkin of Iowa, says USDA should fix testing problems, not weaken enhanced surveillance started 2 years ago after a confirmed case of mad cow disease in Washington state. Harkin says reduced testing means only a 90% chance of catching mad cow cases versus nearly 100% with the more frequent testing.
It is an ironclad. That's why the testing has got to continue to provide some assurances to the public.
Harkin argues USDA's 07 budget request cuts funds for testing at a time when the U.S. needs to restore consumer confidence and restore export markets. Japan and Korea remain closed to U.S. beef after a second case of bovine spongiform encephalopathy, or BSE, was found in a Texas animal last year. A third case was confirmed in Alabama this month. At the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, CEO Terry Stokes claims that enhanced surveillance did its job, and now it's time to return to normal levels of testing.
USDA put that in place to demonstrate that the prevalence of BSE in this country was extremely, extremely low. They've tested over 650,000 animals, and it's achieved its objective. And reducing the level of testing will not have an impact upon the purpose of that program.
Meantime, Senator Harkin says it's time to expand the nation's ban on feeding cow parts to cows to other unsafe practices.
We take ruminant animal parts, and then you grind that up and you feed it to chickens. Well, it gets in the chicken litter. Then you pick up the chicken litter and you feed it back to cows. That's still going on. That should not be allowed. And the sooner we put an end to that, the better off we're all going to be.
Harkin says the last thing the U.S. beef industry needs is for a consumer here to die of Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease, the human form of mad cow disease. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Matt Kay in Washington.
This year, some candidates are using the impeachment of President Bush as their central campaign issue. And as Leanne Caldwell reports from D.C., that will be their first priority when they are elected to office.
Jeannie Crescenzo is a former business owner with a husband and two grown kids. With no political experience, she's now running for Congress.
We have been lied to and lied to and lied to in every respect. It's not just the war, it's the environment, it's our civil rights being taken away. There is no respect for people in this administration. We are just peons to be used and abused for them to get where they want to go.
And because of this, she is calling for the impeachment of President Bush and Vice President Cheney, and she is using that as a central issue for her campaign. Crescenzo would like to see Bush impeached over statements he attaches to bills he signs into law. For example, when Bush signed into law the McCain torture bill that mandated that the U.S. follow its own laws that limit torture, the president attached a signing statement to that bill that said he can authorize torture when necessary. Crescenzo says the president added signing statements more than 400 times, more than all U.S. presidents combined.
What this means is that this president can take any bill that's put through Congress and by signing it completely change the meaning and the intent of that bill. So say that we do get, and God, I hope we do, get a majority in Congress in November. And we put through as one of our first actions to end this war, this illegal occupation of Iraq. Well, when that bill gets in front of George Bush, he can attach a signing statement that would completely negate everything we're trying to do.
Crescenzo says after impeachment, Congress must call for an end to the war in Iraq. She is running against Republican incumbent Daryl Issa for a Southern California seat. He is a longtime conservative House member who supports many of the president's policies. Crescenzo is just one of 16 candidates running for Congress on the impeachment platform. The reasons they call for impeachment include the war in Iraq, the domestic spying program, and presidential abuse of power. In the Senate 2 weeks ago, Democratic Senator Russ Feingold called for a censure or scolding of the president over his domestic wiretapping program. He has received little support so far from fellow senators. Three of the impeachment candidates are running for Senate. In Rhode Island, Senate candidate Carl Sheeler is a veteran. He is involved in a Democratic primary to unseat moderate Republican incumbent Lincoln Chafee. Sheeler has a billboard on I-95 that depicts the Declaration of Independence in the background and reads, "Be patriotic, impeach Bush." Again, Crescenzo.
What's more encouraging is that there are people that are running on a progressive platform, which includes impeachment.
Candidates often try to appeal to the undecided or swing voters. But David Swanson, the Washington director of ImpeachPAC.org, says that impeachment as a main issue is essential for Democrats to win.
It's a great issue for a majority of Americans and for a vast majority of Democrats and activists and people who might turn out and vote in an off-year election if they have a reason to. And, you know, the Democrats have been running on being the non-Republicans with nothing to say and losing at it for years. So for them to whisper about that they'll do this after the election, well, that's the way to lose elections.
No incumbent members of Congress running for re-election this year have announced they will use impeachment as their platform. Although Representative John Conyers from Detroit is calling for an investigation of impeachment of both the president and the vice president, he has about 30 co-sponsors. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
MSNBC reports today the Pentagon is developing plans on how it would react if a full-scale civil war erupted in Iraq. U.S. military officials told the network if the sectarian conflict worsens, more American soldiers and Marines could be sent to fight directly against ethnic militias. Meantime, negotiations over a new government continue in Baghdad, while local leaders deal with continued tensions. David Enders files this report from Iraqi Kurdistan, where riots erupted last week against the Kurdish government.
At the office of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, a London-based NGO that trains local journalists, Marwan Hama plays a mini-disc recording of Kurdish security forces opening fire on demonstrators in Halabja on Thursday, killing one. Hama said he was planning to write an editorial on what happened, but was debating whether to put his name to it, as journalists covering Thursday's events were beaten and detained by Kurdish security forces, and on Friday, one of the organizers of the demonstration, 51-year-old Ali Sofi, was shot at a checkpoint, along with a 4-year-old riding in his car. Hama said that the demonstration should have come as no surprise to Kurdish officials, as students who had planned it 3 weeks prior to the ceremony marking the gassing of 5,000 Kurds by Saddam Hussein's government had told Kurdish officials of their plans. Until the run-up to January's national and local elections, anti-government demonstrations in Kurdistan had been rare. But in January, students at Koye University, an hour from Sulaymaniyah, and at Sulaymaniyah University, demonstrated against corruption and the lack of services provided by the two main Kurdish parties that have ruled Kurdistan since it was liberated from Saddam Hussein's government in 1991. In both cases, demonstrators were shot at and arrested. Demonstrations also took place last week in Koye over the lack of funds and services for university students.
They had taken injured students, not to hospital, to jail.
In addition to the students, Islamic Kurdish parties that took 15 of the 111 seats in the Kurdish regional parliament have also tried to capitalize on dissatisfaction with the government. Hassan Babakir is one of the members of parliament from Kemal, one of the two main Kurdish Islamic parties, and points out, as did residents of Halabja, that the city, despite being one of the most potent symbols of Hussein's abuses, still bears the scars of the attack that took place 18 years ago.
The people in Halabja have been waiting to get something from the government because most of the city was destroyed. Halabja was a big town, and the government has not done enough.
Jalal Talabani's Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, one of the two main parties and the one that is in control of Sulaymaniyah, has blamed the demonstrations on Islamic radicals. But Hamas says this is not the case, and that the dissatisfaction could make Islamic parties increasingly popular as a third option.
During January's elections, security forces loyal to Masoud Barzani's Kurdistan Democratic Party, the region's other main party, attacked officials of the Islamic Union of Kurdistan, the biggest Kurdish Islamic party.
I'm sure if it continues like that, their future will not be better like than Fatah in Palestine. But Fatah, there is one difference. Fatah accepted the result, but I'm sure they will not even accept the results of election. We saw what happened during the election. They attacked Islamic Union of Kurdistan, and they killed several of them because they were having a different slate. They beat up the Secretary General when he was voting.
During the weekend, negotiations between different factions took place in Halabja, but Hama says the issue is unlikely to be settled soon. Before the liberation of Kurdistan, he says, officials often use the specter of Saddam's terror to justify repressive tactics, but a new generation is demanding better government.
I have the most respect for them. They have been doing good in order to liberate us, but they have failed to serve us. I mean, I don't need slogans like Ba'ath like that, Ba'ath is terrible, Arab are chauvinist. I don't believe in that anymore. I need universities, I need roads paved. I don't want to see officials who control everything. I don't want to see officials who has houses by $10 million. And while people are suffering under very, very, very poor situation. It is really shocking to be fired by Kurdish security who are supposed to protect them. Halabja was the latest, in fact, but was the biggest one. And I don't think Halabja will be the last place to demonstrate.
In Sulaymaniyya, I'm David Enders reporting for FSRN.
The militant Islamic group Hamas moved a step closer to taking control of the Palestinian cabinet today, calling on a special session of parliament to approve its new cabinet, sweeping aside objections from the Palestinian president over its refusal to recognize Israel. The move came as the executive committee of the Palestinian Liberation Organization rejected the political program of the Islamic movement. Hamas came to power by sweeping Palestinian elections in late January. From Bethlehem, Manar Jabrin has more.
At the beginning of this week, after several rounds of meetings with the Palestinian factions, Hamas failed to form a national coalition government. The Palestinian Prime Minister-designate Ismail Haniyeh submitted a list of 24 cabinet ministers to President Mahmoud Abbas, most of which are from Hamas, the rest are independent. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine was the last bloc to decide not to join Hamas government, following the lead of the other parliamentary blocs. Jamil Majdalawi, parliament member of the PFLP, said the major conflict issue is Hamas' failure to recognize the Palestinian Liberation Organization as the sole representative of the Palestinian people.
Our brothers in Hamas wanted to build on what came in the Cairo Agreement in March 2005 that states the need to restructure and reactivate the PLO, the sole and legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. We asked Hamas to include the Cairo Agreement as a package in the program. However, they said they will not recognize the PLO as a representative of the Palestinian people, arguing that it represents only a part of the nation as long as Hamas is not represented in the leadership of the organization.
Hamas failed to bridge the gap with Fatah, the second biggest parliamentary bloc. All of the meetings held between the two parties were unfruitful. Mohammed Al-Hurani, member of Fatah Revolutionary Council, said that Fatah cannot join a government that will be isolated.
For us, the issue is related to the political program of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which is widely accepted among the Palestinians. No Palestinian government will be able to function well if not guided by the political program of the PLO. Failure to come up with such a program means choosing isolation. Fatah will never join a government that will put the Palestinian people in isolation from the international and the Arab world.
Hamas, on the other hand, said that the movement as a large political faction is not represented in the PLO, therefore it cannot represent the whole nation, adding that, according to the Palestinian law, the Palestinian parliament is the one who has the last call in this issue. Going to power alone, Hamas faces a number of challenges, including the security chaos that labeled the last few months and the financial crisis caused by the European Union's threats to withhold aid to the Palestinians unless Hamas recognizes Israel and denounces armed resistance. This is Manar Jibrin reporting for FSRN from IMMC.org from Bethlehem, Palestine.
Six public school districts and three families filed suit against the state of Oregon Tuesday over inadequate school funding. Led by the Oregon School Funding Defense Foundation, the plaintiffs charged the state legislature with betraying its constitutional duty to allocate sufficient funds to provide all 550,000 K-12 students with quality education. Kirsten Flagg has more from Oregon.
And the first thing I want you to do is Google your critter, plus I want this word adaptations there.
Carol Blanc leads her biology class step by step through an internet search, taking advantage of the 1 week this year when her students will have access to laptop computers. Blanc teaches at rural Pendleton High School in eastern Oregon. The Pendleton School District was the first of six districts to join the lawsuit filed Tuesday against the state of Oregon. Lack of funding for technology is just one of the complaints of a district that has been forced to cut a quarter of its staff in the last 7 years.
We're really working hard on getting technology, but our budget is absolutely zero. In fact, our technology budget at our high school last year was zero. I just spent the last 3 weeks writing a grant to get something. I would like some technology in my classroom. And in order to do that, you have to write grants. The kids are, this is where their interest is. This is where their passion is. And if you don't have the equipment, it is very hard to motivate.
Many trace Oregon's school budget woes back to 1990's voter-approved Measure 5, which shifted school funding power from local districts to the state legislature at the same time that it placed a cap on property taxes. Without a sales tax, Oregon relies heavily on property and income taxes for revenue. Per pupil funding fell from $4,100 in the 1990-91 school year to $3,400 in 2004-05, according to the Oregon Department of Education. As plaintiffs note in the lawsuit, in 2002, the state ranked 48th nationally in primary school student-teacher ratios. Lead attorney Art Johnson graduated from the participating school district of Eugene.
I had the blessing of going to public schools in Eugene, Oregon that prepared me to go on further. And there's no comparison between the opportunity that was given to me and the opportunity that's being given to the same children today. There's a moral question, there's an ethical question, but in this lawsuit there's a constitutional question, and the legislature has failed and should be held accountable for failing to meet its constitutional obligation.
In 2000, Oregon citizens voted for Measure 1, which requires the legislature to provide a sufficient sum of money to meet the state's own goals for a quality education. Formed by the legislature in response to this mandate, the Oregon Quality Education Commission said schools needed a minimum of $7.1 billion for the biennium budget of 2005-07. However, the legislature only approved $5.3 billion. Pendleton School Board member Dave Becky.
I think we have cut prudently. Probably have done as good a job as any district in the state in managing the scarce resources. And I think we just, as a board, when presented with this offer, thought it was a good way to send a message to the state legislature that something needs to be done for a long-term cure for financing public schools. And if nothing else, it will draw public attention.
Similar lawsuits have been filed in 38 other states. 21 were successful in court. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kirsten Flagg.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aaron Klan, sitting in for Aldo Bogado.